emotion, we can discover the nature of our mind and learn to soothe our emotional reactivity. This will leave us less vulnerable to the destructive emotions and thought patterns that cause us so much suffering. This is the process of developing mental immunity. The Archbishop was simply reminding us that even with this immunity, there will be times when we will have negative or destructive emotions, and when this does happen, the last thing we want to do is judge ourselves harshly. In other words, the Dalai Lama was saying that if we eat healthy, take our vitamins, and get enough rest, we can stay healthy. And the Archbishop was saying, yes, even so, there will be times when we will catch a cold, and we should not make it worse by beating up on ourselves. So how do we deal with these obstacles to joy, the inevitable sources of suffering, both internal and external, that cause so much pain and anguish in our lives, when they do arise? These range from the everyday troubles of stress, frustration, and worry, to the life-defining experiences of adversity, illness, and ultimately, having to face death. We cannot control the inevitability of these occurrences, but both men agreed that we could influence their effect in our life by adjusting the attitude we take toward them. The first step is to accept the reality of suffering. The Buddha is supposed to have said, I have taught one thing and one thing only, suffering and the cessation of suffering. The first noble truth of Buddhism is that life is filled with suffering. The Sanskrit word for suffering is dukkha, not to be confused with the nutty and very tasty Egyptian condiment, dukkha. Dukkha can be translated as stress, anxiety, suffering, or dissatisfaction. It is often described as the mental and physical suffering that occurs in life, illness, and aging. It is also described as the stress and anxiety that arise from the attempt to control what is fundamentally impermanent and unable to be controlled. We try to control the moment, which results in our feeling that what is happening should not be happening. So much of what causes heartache is our wanting things to be different than they are.
I think, in many cases, you develop some sort of unhappiness, some discontent, which leads to frustration and anger.
While stress and frustration may sound like superficial problems or complaints, the Buddha identified them as the core of so much of our unnecessary or created suffering. I was reminded of what the Dalai Lama had said on our first day. We cannot end natural disasters or the suffering they cause, but so much of the rest of our suffering we can. Dukkha, or suffering, is the opposite of sukha, which means happiness, ease, or comfort. Both words are said to have originated from the ancient Aryans who brought the Sanskrit language to India. These Aryans were a nomadic people who traveled by horse or ox-drawn carts, and the words literally mean having a bad or good axle. Was it a bumpy ride, dukkha, or a smooth ride, sukha? Not a bad metaphor for life. What is suffering but a bumpy ride? Every life is rutted, and no one can avoid some inevitable bumps, but so much is determined by our own perception of the ride. Our mind is the axle that often determines whether we experience the ride as bumpy or smooth. This point was brought home to me in a rather literal way when I went to Dharamsala in January, several months before the dialogues, with Peggy Callahan. Peggy was responsible for filming the week in Dharamsala, and we went to prepare for the April visit. Our return flight from the cloud-covered Dharamsala airport was canceled, so we embarked on a bumpy and winding expedition to the nearest airport, holding tightly to the hand straps in the car as we bounced up and down and were tossed from side to side. We tried hard not to get car sick and distracted ourselves by telling each other humorous stories from our travels, stretching each story as long as possible during the bone-shaking 6-hour journey.
We have perceptions about our experience, and we judge them. This is good, this is bad, this is neutral. Then we have responses. Fear, frustration, anger. We realize that these are just different aspects of mind. They are not the actual reality. Similarly, fearlessness, kindness, love, and forgiveness are also aspects of mind. It is very useful to know the system of emotion and to understand how our mind works. When a fear or frustration comes, we have to think, what is causing it? In most cases, fear is simply a mental projection. When I was young and living in Potala, there was an area that was very dark, and there were stories about ghosts there. So when I was passing through this area, I would feel something. This was completely a mental projection.
No, there were ghosts there, man.
When a mad dog approaches, barking and gnashing its teeth, then you need fear. That's not a mental projection. So you have to analyze the causes of fear. With frustration, often you see someone and you have a mental projection even when his or her face is neutral. Similarly, when you see someone's actions, you have a mental projection even when their behavior is neutral. So you have to ask yourself, if your frustration is based on something real, even if someone criticizes you or attacks you, then you have to think, why did this happen? This person is not your enemy from birth. Certain circumstances cause the person to be negative toward you. There may be many causes, but usually your own attitude is an important contributing factor that cannot be ignored. You realize that this happened because you have done something in the past that this person didn't like. So then when you realize your own part in the other person's criticizing or attacking you, the intensity of your frustration and anger automatically reduces. Then you also realize that basic human nature is good, is compassionate, and that the person does not want to harm you. So therefore you see the emotion is due to some misunderstanding or misinformation. You see that this person's actions are due to their own destructive emotions. You can develop a sense of concern, compassion, even feel sorry for their pain and suffering. How sad that this person is out of control, or having such a negative feeling. Instead of frustration and anger, you feel sorry for the other person and concern for them.
I nodded my head and said, but sometimes our frustration is not dependent on other people, but on circumstances beyond our control. For example, we can't control canceled flights.
When I was young and very eager to do something, they would announce that there was a delay or cancellation of the flight. I would feel angry, and sometimes angry toward the pilot or toward the airline. Before there was air service from Dharamsala to Delhi, I would go to the city of Jammu, about 4 hours' drive, to fly. So, one morning, all the passengers were on the airplane when they announced that the flight had been cancelled, and that everyone should please leave the airplane. Later, I was told that the pilot did not come because he was drinking too much the night before. So everyone was complaining, and I felt frustrated too. Now, when an announcement comes that my flight is cancelled or postponed, which does happen quite a lot here, I take it as a good opportunity to sit and do my practice, to sit and meditate. So now I feel less frustration.
I was reminded of a flight that I had been on with Rachel, our then 2-year-old son Jesse, and my mother to Hawaii. We did not have very much money and had booked seats on the cheapest airline we could find. They had only 2 planes that they would shuttle back and forth to Hawaii and other holiday destinations. We were almost halfway over the Pacific from California to Oahu when I felt a sudden jerk, like someone had shoved the plane from the side. Then the plane made a sweeping turn, and some time later the crew made an announcement that we were heading back to San Francisco. I remember being very angry and frustrated. We had to spend the whole day waiting for another plane, so we tried to begin our vacation in California taking Jesse to the zoo. It was fun, but I felt angry that our Hawaiian holiday was being cut short. When we finally returned to the airport and got ready to board, I overheard the pilot reveal to another member of the crew the reason for turning around. Apparently, one of the bolts had come loose in one of the engines. The pilot, casually mentioned, in the way of people who are used to calmly handling high-risk situations, that if they had not shut off the engine at the moment that they did, it would have sheared off and the airplane would have crashed into the ocean. Suddenly, a delayed flight and a day at the zoo didn't sound so bad after all.
I used to feel very frustrated and angry when we would be rushing to a very important meeting and we would be stuck in traffic because there was an accident up ahead. You were grinding your teeth and looking for somebody to kick. But growing older, I said, well, this is an opportunity for being quiet. And then you would try to uphold all the people that were involved. I mean, there's not very much you can do, so grinding your teeth and getting heated up doesn't help. So why not use the old things that they tell you? Count to 10. 1, 2, 3,
The Archbishop pretended to lose his temper despite his trying to count to 10.
I think it takes time to learn to be laid back. You know, it's not something that just comes ready-made for you. No one ought to feel annoyed with themselves. It just adds to the frustration. I mean, we are human beings, fallible human beings. And as the Dalai Lama points out, there was a time, I mean, we see him serene and calm. Yet there were times when he, too, felt annoyed, and perhaps there still are. It's like muscles that have to be exercised to be strong. Sometimes we get too angry with ourselves, thinking that we ought to be perfect from the word go. But this being on earth is a time for us to learn to be good, to learn to be more loving, to learn to be more compassionate. And you learn not theoretically. You learn when something happens that tests you. Hello, you said you wanted to be more compassionate. Hello, you wanted to be a little more laid back. We get very angry with ourselves. We think we ought to be supermen and superwomen from the start. The Dalai Lama's serenity didn't come fully formed. It was through the practice of prayer and meditation that the gentleness, the compassion grew. His being patient and accepting within reasonable limits, accepting circumstances as they are, because if there are circumstances that you cannot change, then it's no use beating your head against a brick wall. That just gives you a headache. This is a veil of growth and development.
I was struck by the phrase, a veil of growth and development, which seemed to echo the famous Christian notion that life is a veil, or valley, of tears, from which we are freed only when we enter heaven. This expression is often said to be based on Psalm, chapter 84, verse 6, which has the beautiful wording, "Who passing through the veil of tears makes it a well." Indeed, we can use our tears, our stress and frustration, as a well from which we can draw the life-giving waters of our emotional and spiritual growth.
It's similar to how we learn to be a parent. You learn how to react to a child who is really frustrating you. You are better with your third child than you were with your first child. And so I would say to everyone, you are made for perfection, but you are not yet perfect. You are a masterpiece in the making.
Fear, stress, and anxiety. I would be very nervous.
We all have fears. Fear and anxiety are mechanisms that have helped us to survive. You know, if you did not feel fear when you saw a lion over there, and you just walked merrily by, in next to no time, there would be no you. God has given us these things because God knew that we needed them. Otherwise, we would be fearless. But then, we'd also be very stupid, and we would not be around very long. The problem is when the fear is exaggerated, or when it is provoked by something that is really quite insignificant.
When I asked the Archbishop how he managed the fear during the dark days of apartheid, when he received frequent death threats, he said, "Well, one did not do silly things like stand in front of a lit window at night. But one had to say to God, 'If I am doing your work, you better jolly well protect me.'" I have always been impressed with how the Archbishop has been willing to admit his fears and frailties. We so rarely hear about the doubts, fears, and worries of leaders, as leadership itself seems to require an air of confidence and rarely allows the admission of weakness or vulnerability. I was once told an amazing story by former Time magazine editor Rick Stengel, who had worked with Nelson Mandela on his autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom. Mandela was flying in a small propeller plane with his bodyguard, Mike. The great leader was hidden behind the morning paper when he noticed that one propeller was not working. He leaned over and calmly told Mike, who informed the pilot. They were well aware of the problem and explained that emergency landing procedures were in place. When Mike explained the situation to Mandela, he nodded calmly and went back to reading his paper. Apparently Mike, a tough guy, was trembling with fear, but only calmed by the image of Mandela, who looked unbothered by the fact that they might at any moment fall out of the sky. When they had gotten into the back of the bulletproof BMW that met them at the airport, Stengel asked him about the flight, to which Mandela leaned in, eyes wide, and said, "Man, I was terrified up there." Even if leadership requires a show of strength during moments of crisis, our humanity is defined equally, or perhaps even more, by our weakness and vulnerability, a fact that the Archbishop often says reminds us of our need for one another. One of my favorite quotes that we included in Mandela's book Notes to the Future was on courage. "I learned that courage was not the absence of fear, but the triumph over it. I felt fear more times than I can remember, but I hid it behind a mask of boldness. The brave man is not he who does not feel afraid, but he who conquers that fear." Archbishop Tutu said something very similar when we were working on God Has a Dream. He said, "Courage is not the absence of fear, but the ability to act despite it." The English word courage comes from the French word cœur, or heart. Courage is indeed the triumph of our heart's love and commitment over our mind's reasonable murmurings to keep us safe. As the Archbishop had said, it is when this natural fear gets exaggerated that we experience stress, worry, and anxiety. Many of us suffer from this general state of unease, during which we have floating fears and worries that attach to any experience or relationship. It is very hard to be joyful with stress and anxiety. We have a continual feeling of being overwhelmed and not being able to handle our work commitments, our family commitments, or the digital devices that are constantly reminding us of all the things that we are missing. Juggling so many things at the same time, we can feel like we are always one step behind. Jimpa pointed out that modern society has prioritized independence to such an extent that we are left on our own to try to manage lives that are increasingly out of control. He explained the life that the Dalai Lama and his people had in Tibet before the Chinese invasion. In the remote village of Toksur, in the Amdo province, the Dalai Lama's family house, like the others in the village, was located on a plateau overlooking the rolling grasslands filled with nomads and yaks. The Dalai Lama was one of 16 children, 9 of whom died in infancy. The nearest town was 3 hours away by mule. The boy, then called Lamo Thundup, slept in the kitchen closest to the stove. Life could not have been easy for him and his family, so it was a surprise to me when Jimpa explained that life would have been much less stressful in a traditional village. For much of human history, whether in Tibet or Africa or anywhere in between, there were fears and worries, some of them major, like whether there would be enough food for the winter. But these concerns were made more manageable by having a close and connected life. While survival certainly is the greatest stressor of all, for which our stress response evolved, there is something different about the constant pressures and pulls of modern life. Although there would no doubt have been times of great stress and anxiety at the loss of crops or even the loss of a child, the daily rhythms would have been far less frenzied and unfocused. There is a wisdom that has been lost, Jinpa said. Our opportunities are so much greater now, but so too are our anxieties. I thought of the journey, both physical and psychological, that Jinpa had undertaken, from life in a Buddhist monastery that was largely unchanged for thousands of years, to the family life he now lives in Montreal. But if stress and anxiety are inevitable parts of modern life, how can we begin to confront these ever-present irritants? How do we make the ride smoother? How do we minimize the worry we experience?
Stress and anxiety often come from too much expectation and too much ambition. Then, when we don't fulfill that expectation or achieve that ambition, we experience frustration. Right from the beginning, it is a self-centered attitude. I want this. I want that. Often, we are not being realistic about our own ability or about objective reality. When we have a clear picture about our own capacity, we can be realistic about our effort. Then there is a much greater chance of achieving our goals. But unrealistic effort only brings disaster. So, in many cases, our stress is caused by our expectations and our ambition.
What is too much ambition, I wondered. For someone raised in America, where ambition is a virtue in and of itself, the marriage of initiative and persistence, I was struck by his answer. Could it be that all of the getting and grasping that we see as our major ambition in modern life might be misguided? And perhaps the belief that more is better might be a recipe for stress and frustration, and ultimately dissatisfaction. Perhaps it is a question of priorities. What is it that is really worth pursuing? What is it we truly need? According to the Archbishop and the Dalai Lama, when we see how little we really need, love and connection, then all the getting and grasping that we thought was so essential to our well-being takes its rightful place and no longer becomes the focus or the obsession of our lives. We must try to be conscious about how we live and not get swept away by the modern trance, the relentless march, the anxious accelerator. The Dalai Lama was urging us to be more realistic so we can come to some sense of inner peace now, rather than always chasing after our expectations and ambition for the next. Symptoms of chronic stress are feelings of fragmentation and chasing after time, of not being able to be present. What we are looking for is a settled, joyful state of being, and we need to give this state space. The Archbishop once told me that people often think he needs time to pray and reflect because he is a religious leader. He said those who must live in the marketplace, business people, professionals, and workers, need it even more. As chronic stress becomes a global epidemic, our stress response is being studied intensively to see if we can unwind its mysteries. It turns out that our perspective has a surprising amount of influence over the body's stress response. When we turn a threat into a challenge, our body responds very differently. Psychologist Alyssa Epple is one of the leading researchers on stress, and she explained to me how stress is supposed to work. Our stress response, evolved to save us from attack or danger, like a hungry lion or a falling avalanche. Cortisol and adrenaline course into our blood. This causes our pupils to dilate so we can see more clearly, our heart and breathing to speed up so we can respond faster, and the blood to divert from our organs to our large muscles so we can fight or flee. This stress response evolved as a rare and temporary experience. But for many in our modern world, their stress response is constantly activated. Epple and her colleague, Nobel Prize-winning molecular biologist Elizabeth Blackburn, have found that constant stress actually wears down our telomeres, the caps on our DNA that protect our cells from illness and aging. It is not just stress, but our thought patterns in general that impact our telomeres, which has led Epple and Blackburn to conclude that our cells are actually listening to our thoughts. The problem is not the existence of stressors, which cannot be avoided. Stress is simply the brain's way of signaling that something is important. The problem, or perhaps the opportunity, is how we respond to this stress. Eppel and Blackburn explain that it is not the stress alone that damages our telomeres. It is our response to the stress that is most important. They encourage us to develop stress resilience. This involves turning what is called threat stress, or the perception that a stressful event is a threat that will harm us, into what is called challenge stress, or the perception that a stressful event is a challenge that will help us grow. The remedy they offer is quite straightforward. One simply notices the fight or flight stress response in one's body, the beating heart, the pulsing blood or tingling feeling in our hands and face, the rapid breathing, then remembers that these are natural responses to stress and that our body is just preparing to rise to the challenge. What determines whether we see something or someone as a threat? The Archbishop and the Dalai Lama were saying that so much of our stress is dependent on seeing ourselves as separate from others, which perhaps returns to the loss of our sense of communal connection, of Ubuntu. I had once asked the Archbishop how he handled worry and insomnia, and he said that he thought about people all around the world who also were awake and unable to sleep. Thinking about others and remembering that he was not alone lessened his distress and his worries, as he would say a prayer for them.
I would give teachings when I was young. I would be very nervous because I did not see myself as the same as the people in the audience. Then, after 1959, when I left Tibet, I started thinking, these people are just like me, same human being. If we think we are something special, or not special enough, then fear, nervousness, stress, and anxiety arise. We are the same.
What the Dalai Lama and I are offering is a way of handling your worries, thinking about others. You can think about others who are in a similar situation, or perhaps even in a worse situation, but who have survived, even thrived. It does help quite a lot to see yourself as part of a greater whole. Once again, the path of joy was connection, and the path of sorrow was separation. When we see others as separate, they become a threat. When we see others as part of us, as connected, as interdependent, then there is no challenge we cannot face together.
When I meet someone, I always try to relate to the person on a basic human level. On that level, I know that, just like me, he or she wishes to find happiness, to have fewer problems and less difficulty in their life. Whether I am speaking with one person or whether I am giving a talk to a large group of people, I always see myself first and foremost as just another fellow human. That way, there is, in fact, no need for introduction. If, on the other hand, I relate to others from the perspective of myself as someone different, a Buddhist, a Tibetan, and so on, I will then create walls to keep me apart from others. And if I relate to others, thinking that I am the Dalai Lama, I will create the basis for my own separation and loneliness. After all, there is only one Dalai Lama in the entire world. In contrast, if I see myself primarily in terms of myself as a fellow human, I will then have more than 7 billion people who I can feel deep connection with. And this is wonderful, isn't it? What do you need to fear or worry about when you have 7 billion other people who are with you?
Frustration and anger. I would shout. More than a decade before coming to Dharamsala, I was driving with the Archbishop in Jacksonville, Florida, in traffic. You could say that this was, in fact, one of my major motivations for wanting to work with him. To understand, how does a deeply spiritual and moral leader drive in traffic? We had left the house where we had earlier recorded an interview, sitting by the alligator pond, dangling our feet precariously close to the hungry water. We stopped off at the Boston Market restaurant chain for a quick lunch, where he had gone out of his way to greet and say hello to all of the employees, who were in awe of their celebrity customer, who was ordering chicken and mashed potatoes. We were on our way to the university where he was a guest lecturer, and I was interviewing him as we drove, trying to use every precious moment of our time together to gather his pearls of wisdom. We were talking about many high-minded philosophies and theologies, but what I really wanted to know was how all this spiritual practice and beliefs affected his day-to-day interactions, like driving in traffic. All of a sudden, a car cut across the lanes in front of us, and the Archbishop had to swerve out of the way to avoid hitting the other car. "There are some truly amazing drivers on the road," the Archbishop said with exasperation and a head-shaking chuckle. I asked him what went through his head at moments like this, and he said that perhaps the driver was on his way to the hospital because his wife was giving birth or a relative was sick. There it was. He reacted with the inevitable and uncontrollable surprise, which is one of our instinctual responses. But then instead of taking the low road of anger, he took the high road of humor, acceptance, and even compassion. And it was gone. No fuming, no lingering frustration, no raised blood pressure. We often think of fear and anger as two quite separate emotions, so I was surprised to hear the Dalai Lama connect them.
Where there is fear, frustration will come. Frustration brings anger. So, you see, fear and anger are very close.
The Dalai Lama's perspective, I later learned, is supported by our basic biology. Fear and anger are two poles of our natural response as we prepare to flee, fear, or to fight, anger. The Dalai Lama was responding to one of the students at the Tibetan Children's Village, where we went later in the week to celebrate his birthday. One of the older students had asked, "Your Holiness, how do you control your anger in your daily life?" The Archbishop started to cackle, not just laughing, but practically doubling over, presumably enjoying immensely the challenge that anger poses, even to holy men.
"When I used to get angry, I would shout. I have a story. Around 1956 or 57, when I was in my early 20s, I had an old car, which belonged to the 13th Dalai Lama. It was one of the very few cars in Lhasa at the time, and had been carried in pieces to the capital and reassembled, since there were no drivable roads in Tibet at the time, other than short stretches in and around Lhasa. One of the people who used to drive the car would also repair it when it broke down, which was quite often. One day, he was under the car repairing it when I came by to see him. As he came out from under the car, he banged his head on the fender. This made him lose his temper. He was so mad that he banged his head against the car again and again. Bang, bang, bang. That is anger. What use is it? The very reason he lost his temper is that he hit his head, and then he hit his head on purpose, inflicting more pain on himself. He's foolish. When anger develops, think. What is the cause? And then also think, what will be the result of my anger? My angry face or my shouting? Then you will realize that anger is not helpful."
Neuropsychiatrist Daniel Siegel explains that when we get very angry, we can flip our lid, so to speak, losing the benefit of our critical thinking cortex. As a result, the prefrontal cortex, which is important for emotion regulation and moral judgment, loses its ability to control our emotional limbic system. The Dalai Lama's driver had flipped his lid, and as a result, he acted in a rather silly way, causing himself even more pain. This scene is comical because it is so common. We've all been there. So what is the alternative to losing it? The Dalai Lama then made the subtle and profound connection between fear and anger, explaining how fear underlies anger. Typically, frustration and anger come from being hurt. The driver hitting his head was an obvious example. In addition to physical pain, we can also experience emotional pain which may be even more common. We want something that we did not get, like respect or kindness, or we get something that we did not want, like disrespect or criticism. Underlying this anger, the Dalai Lama was saying, is a fear that we will not get what we need, that we are not loved, that we are not respected, that we will not be included. One way out of anger, then, is to ask, what is the hurt that has caused our anger? What is the fear that we have? Psychologists often call anger a secondary emotion because it comes as a defense to feeling threatened. When we can acknowledge and express the fear, how we are feeling threatened, then we are often able to soothe the anger. But we need to be willing to admit our vulnerability. We are often ashamed of these fears and hurts, thinking that if we were invulnerable, we would never experience pain. But this, as the Archbishop said, is not the nature of being human. If we can have compassion for ourselves and acknowledge how we feel afraid, hurt, or threatened, we can have compassion for others, possibly even for those who have evoked our anger.
When you set yourself goals and you encounter obstacles, you will naturally feel frustrated. Or when you are trying to do your best and those with whom you are working or should be working aren't as cooperative as you had hoped, or at home with your family when something you do is misconstrued, this inevitably leads to frustration and anger. When people impugn your intentions, and you know that you have noble intentions, it's really quite painful. You grind your teeth and you say, there they go again. Or on a larger scale, at home when we were involved in the apartheid struggle, and there were those amongst us who used methods that were not acceptable, like necklacing, where they would set somebody alight with a car tire filled with gasoline around their neck and kill them. And you wanted to say, we don't need this. It just makes it easier for them to criticize us and our movement. Or in a personal way, when you have to deal with physical ailments, and you wish maybe that you had a great deal more energy than you in fact have. One is reminded of one's humanity and one's fragility.
One time, I was in Jerusalem, and I met with a teacher who used to tell his students, when you are irritated or angry with someone, you should remember that they are made in the image of God. Some of the students in the class were Palestinians, and they had to cross through Israeli checkpoints. They told him that when they would get nervous and irritated, they would think that these soldiers were made in the image of God, and they would relax and feel better. At the physical level, one has to act accordingly. But at the mental level, one can remain calm and relaxed. This is how you train the mind.
Yet certainly anger must have a place, I thought. Sometimes it serves a role in protecting us or others from hurt or harm. What I wondered was the role of righteous anger. The Archbishop, during the killings that often marred the peaceful protests against apartheid, would raise a fist and a rant, calling down fire and brimstone against the evildoers of injustice. His biography by his longtime press secretary, John Allen, is called Rabble Rouser for Peace, which succinctly describes the paradox of the Archbishop's struggle for freedom. He was not afraid of anger and righteous indignation in pursuit of peace, justice, and equality in his homeland. The Archbishop simply and succinctly explained the power and limits of this use of anger.
Righteous anger is usually not about oneself. It is about those whom one sees being harmed and whom one wants to help.
In short, righteous anger is a tool of justice, a scythe of compassion, more than a reactive emotion. Although it may have its roots deep in our fight-or-flight desire to protect those in our family or group who are threatened, it is a chosen response and not simply an uncontrollable reaction. And it is not about one's own besieged self-image or one's feelings of separation, but of one's collective responsibility and one's feeling of deep, empowering connection.
Now, medical scientists say that constant fear, constant anger, constant Hatred harms our immune system. Everybody tries to take care of his or her health, so they need both a healthy body and a healthy mind. A healthy mind is a calm mind. Fear and anger are destroyers of a calm mind. Then you realize that anger is no use in solving problems. It will not help. It creates more problems. Then eventually, through training of our mind and using reasoning, we can transform our emotions.
The Dalai Lama added, "Clear like that," as if fear and anger, those fundamental parts of the human experience, these sources of so much negative emotion, so much suffering, could be banished with the wave of a rational mind. I knew what he was describing was a lifelong practice in which we have to continually wrestle with the fear and anger mechanisms of our mammalian brain. Otherwise, we are prone to lose it more often than we would like to admit. Paul Ekman told me an astonishing story over dinner one night about how the Dalai Lama had healed him of his anger issues. Ekman is not a Buddhist and was not that interested in meeting the Dalai Lama, but his daughter was a fan, and when Ekman heard that scientists invited to the biannual Mind and Life Conference with the Dalai Lama could bring a guest, he agreed to attend. Ekman explained that he used to be a very timid and quiet child, but became what is popularly called a rageaholic after experiencing his father's belligerence and abuse and his mother's suicide. Ekman would have what he and other emotion researchers call regrettable incidents, flying into a rage several times a week. When he went to see the Dalai Lama, something very strange happened. The Dalai Lama took Ekman's hands, looked into his eyes lovingly. And suddenly, Ekman said, it felt like all the anger drained out of his body. He did not have another regrettable incident for over 6 months, and although they did return, they were much less frequent. Ekman does not know what happened to him, but perhaps said that the Dalai Lama's deep compassion had helped heal some lingering hurt and reactivity. The Dalai Lama has asked Ekman to map the emotional landscape, to help others avoid the rocky terrain of negative emotions and find their way more easily to the promised land of compassion and contentment. The Dalai Lama had said earlier that if we can discover our role in creating the situations that upset us, we're able to reduce our feelings of frustration and anger. Also, when we are able to recognize that the other person has their own fears and hurts, their own fragile and human perspective, then we have a chance of escaping from the normal reflex of anger.
And so finally, sometimes it is a matter of timing. Too much tiredness can lead us to feel frustration and anger. In my own case, when I encounter some difficult situation in the morning, my mind is calm. It is much easier. When the same situation happens in the late evening, and I am a little bit tired, then I feel annoyed. So, your basic physical condition makes a difference. Whether your body is fresh, whether your mind is fresh. So this also shows how much depends on your own perception and your limited subjective view.
With that, the Dalai Lama concluded our first morning session as we were about to break for tea. Next, we had planned to discuss sadness and grief, feelings that so many try to avoid. I was very surprised to hear them explain how the royal road to joy would lead right through these emotions. Sadness and grief, the hard times knit us more closely together.
The very first day of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, when one of the witnesses came to tell us about his experiences, it was at the end of a long and grueling day, and he was trying to tell us how they had tortured him. Then there was a point in trying to recall what they had done to him that he found it difficult to speak. He had now developed a speech impediment. I don't know what it was, the recalling or the speech impediment, but the witness was not able to go on. And he started a sentence, and then put his hand up to his eyes and started weeping. And I joined him. At the end of it, I said to my colleagues, I told you, I am not fit to be chairing this. And lo and behold, I was right. I've made a public spectacle of myself. I'm a crybaby. I cry easily. I suppose I love easily, too. And so I think we shouldn't think we are superwomen and supermen. To hold down emotions in a controlled environment, as it were, is not wise. I would say go ahead, and even maybe shout out your sadness and pain. This can bring you back to normal. It's locking them up, and pretending that they are not there that causes them to fester and become a wound. I've not read this in a book. It's just how I have handled them.
Sadness is seemingly the most direct challenge to joy, but as the Archbishop argued strongly, it often leads us more directly to empathy and compassion, and to recognizing our need for one another. Sadness is a very powerful and enduring emotion. In one study, it was found that sadness lasted many times longer than more fleeting emotions like fear and anger. While fear lasted on average 30 minutes, sadness often lasted up to 120 hours, or almost 5 days. While the evolutionary value of our fight, anger, and flight, fear responses are clear, the value of sadness seems harder to understand. New studies conducted by psychology researcher Joseph Forgas show that mild sadness can actually have a number of benefits that could reflect its value. In his experiments, people who were in a sad mood had better judgment and memory and were more motivated, more sensitive to social norms, and more generous than the happier control group. People who are in a so-called negative state of sadness were more discerning about their situation, better able to remember details, and more motivated to change their situation. What is particularly interesting is that brief sadness might generate more empathy or generosity. Participants in the study played a game, part of which involved deciding how much money to give themselves and how much to give others. The sad participants gave significantly more to the other participants. While depression certainly collapses our circle of concern inward, the periodic feeling of sadness might widen it. Forgas concluded that sadness may have some benefit in our lives, which may be why people are drawn to music, art, and literature that makes them feel sad. He urges us to embrace all of our emotions because they no doubt play a necessary role in our lives. Sadness is in many ways the emotion that causes us to reach out to one another in support and solidarity. The Archbishop expressed it quite wonderfully when he explained,
"We don't really get close to others if our relationship is made up of unending honky-doriness. It is the hard times, the painful times, the sadness and the grief that knit us more closely together."
A funeral is perhaps the most obvious example of this weaving of our relationships and community together. But even tears are a signal to others that we need comfort and kindness, that we are vulnerable and need help. We try so hard to separate joy and sorrow into their own boxes, but the Archbishop and the Dalai Lama tell us that they are inevitably fastened together. Neither advocate the kind of fleeting happiness, often called hedonic happiness, that requires only positive states and banishes feelings like sadness to emotional exile. The kind of happiness that they describe is often called eudaimonic happiness and is characterized by self-understanding, meaning, growth, and acceptance, including life's inevitable suffering, sadness, and grief.
I often receive questions from those whose dear friend or parent or even child has passed away. They ask me, what should I do? I share with them from my own experience. My beloved main teacher, who gave me my monk's ordination, died, and I was really grief-stricken. While he was alive, I always felt like he was a solid rock behind me that I could lean on. I really felt very, very sad and full of grief when he passed away. The way through the sadness and grief that comes from great loss is to use it as motivation and to generate a deeper sense of purpose. When my teacher passed away, I used to think that now I have even more responsibility to fulfill his wishes. So my sadness translated into more enthusiasm, more determination. I have told those who had lost their dear friend or family member, it is very sad, but this sadness should translate into more determination to fulfill their wishes. If the one you have lost could see you, and you are determined and full of hope, they would be happy. With the great sadness of the loss, one can live an even more meaningful life. Sadness and grief are, of course, natural human responses to loss. But if your focus remains on the loved one you have just lost, the experience is less likely to lead to despair. In contrast, if your focus, while grieving, remains mostly on yourself, what am I going to do now? How can I cope? Then there is a greater danger of going down the path of despair and depression. So again, so much depends on how we respond to our experience of loss and sadness.
The Dalai Lama mentioned the famous Buddhist story of the woman who had lost her child and was inconsolable in her grief, carrying her dead child throughout the land, begging for someone to help heal her child. When she came to the Buddha, she begged him to help her. He told her he could help her if she would collect mustard seeds for the medicine. She eagerly agreed, but then the Buddha explained that the mustard seeds needed to come from a house that had not been touched by death. When the woman visited each house in search of the mustard seeds that might heal her son, she discovered that there was no house that had not suffered the loss of a parent or a spouse or a child. Seeing that her suffering was not unique, she was able to bury her child in the forest and release her grief. My friend Gordon Wheeler, who is a psychologist, explains that grief is the reminder of the depth of our love. Without love, there is no grief. So when we feel our grief, uncomfortable and aching as it may be, it is actually a reminder of the beauty of that love, now lost. I'll never forget calling Gordon while I was traveling and hearing him say that he was out to dinner by himself after the loss of a dear friend, so he could feel his grief. He knew that in the blinking and buzzing world of our lives, it is so easy to delete the past and move on to the next moment, to linger in the longing, the loss, the yearning, as a way of feeling the rich and embroidered texture of life, the torn cloth of our world that is endlessly being ripped and rewoven. Despair. The world is in such turmoil. It was time to ask the question that people from around the world most wanted me to ask, a question not about joy, but about sorrow, and not about theirs, but about others. People all over the world wanted to know how they could possibly live with joy in a world so filled with sorrow and suffering. A woman named Dawn, who sent in a question, asked it this way. The world is in such turmoil, war, starvation, terrorism, pollution, genocide. My heart hurts for these issues. How do I find joy in the midst of such large world problems? You're the elder, the Dalai Lama said, gesturing to the Archbishop.
You show your humanity by how you see yourself not as apart from others, but from your connection to others. I have frequently wept about the things such as the ones you have mentioned. God created us and said, "Go now, my child. You have freedom." And God has such an incredible reverence for that freedom that God would much rather we went freely to hell than compel us to come to heaven. Yes, we are capable of the most awful atrocities. We can give a catalogue. And God weeps until there are those who say, "I do want to try to do something." It is good also to remember that we have a fantastic capacity for goodness. And then you look again, and you see those doctors and nurses from other parts of the world who go into those situations. I mean, You think of, say, Doctors Without Borders. Why do they go there? I mean, they could stay in France or wherever and have a wonderful practice. But they don't. They go off to some of the most poverty-stricken places. You've seen it with Ebola. People go into a hugely dangerous situation, coming from countries where they don't have Ebola. And they have no reason to go to Sierra Leone or wherever. They are just showing us what we are all capable of being. And by proxy, we link ourselves to those and try as much as we can to enter into who we are, people of compassion. What can you do to help change that situation? You might not be able to do a great deal, but start where you are and do what you can where you are. And yes, be appalled. It would be awful if we looked on all of that horrendousness and we said, ah, it doesn't really matter. It's so wonderful that we can be distressed. That's part of the greatness of who we are. That you are distressed about someone who is not family in any conventional way, and yet you feel distressed equally. It's incredible just how compassionate and generous people can be. When a disaster such as 9/11 happens, we realize we are family. We are family. Those people at the Twin Towers are our sisters and brothers. And even more startlingly, the people who are piloting those planes, they are our sisters and brothers. You have a tsunami happen, and have you seen the outpouring of love and compassion and caring? I mean, you don't know the victim from a brass farthing. And people just gave and gave, because that's actually who we really are. After 9/11, you would have expected that those who hated America would have been gloating. But there were very, very, very few people gloating. People were deeply, deeply distressed. Had the American president not hit back, we might have had a different world. We will have a different world, of course, eventually. But just look at any tragedy. When miners are trapped in Russia, people don't say, I can't speak Russian, or I don't even know where that place is on the map. There is a compassion that just springs up.
The archbishop's and the Dalai Lama's conviction that we would have a different world eventually was striking. Several months after the interviews, I was visiting with the archbishop in South Africa when terrorist attacks took place in Paris. So many people were despairing at humanity's obvious inhumanity. When I asked him what he would say to those who were caught in such despair, he replied,
"Yes, we do have setbacks. But you must keep everything in perspective. The world is getting better. Think about the rights of women, or how slavery was considered morally justified a few hundred years ago. It takes time. We are growing and learning how to be compassionate, how to be caring, how to be human."
Almost a month later to the day, the world came together in Paris and ratified climate change accords that overcame national differences and economic greed to give our world a better chance of survival. The Archbishop often liked to quote one of his heroes, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who in turn was quoting one of his heroes, an abolitionist minister named Theodore Parker, who said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice."
Perhaps here I may mention something from my own experience. March 10th, 2008.
Every year, the Tibetan exile community commemorates March 10th as Tibetan Uprising Day, remembering the 1959 protest against Chinese occupation that ultimately led to the crackdown against the Tibetan freedom movement and the Dalai Lama's flight into exile. In 2008, leading up to the Beijing Olympics, that day had turned violent, starting in the Tibetan capital city of Lhasa and then spreading throughout Tibet and cities around the world.
As usual, we had a gathering to commemorate the 10th of March. After the meeting was over, I received a message from Lhasa that some of the local people had started demonstrations. When I heard this, I was very concerned and quite anxious. I could not do anything. I felt helpless. I knew if they really carried out demonstrations, it would actually result only in more suffering, more problems. And this is exactly what happened, with the violent crackdown and the death and imprisonment of so many Tibetans who had participated in the protests. Over the next few days, during my meditation, I actually visualized some of those Chinese local authorities and did one of our practices called Tonglen, literally meaning giving and taking. I tried to take on their fear, anger, suspicion, and to give them my love, my forgiveness. Of course, this would have no physical effect on the ground. It would not change the situation. But, you see, mentally, it was very, very helpful to keep a calm mind. It was a good opportunity to practice forgiveness and compassion. So I think that every person has this same sort of opportunity, this same capacity.
I do at times get very angry with God.
Some of my friends, when they are really facing some trouble, sometimes they complain at the Buddha. So, similar idea.
Yes, I usually would go to my chapel if I had something that really upset me. I would lambast God. The prophet Jeremiah would say to God, "You misled me. You called me to be a prophet, and I said I don't want to be a prophet. And you said, no, I will be with you. All you have made me say to these people, people I love very much, is to condemn them." And yes, that is how I do it. Jeremiah is my favorite prophet in the Bible for precisely this honesty that he had. You can go to God and speak all you have, pouring it out in that fashion.
I wondered how many times the archbishop, like Jeremiah, had told God he did not want to be a prophet.
I weep when something has happened where I may not be able to assist. I acknowledge that it is something I can do very little about. I remember one of the times that I was quite despairing. Chris Haney was one of our most incredible young leaders. There was no doubt he was going to succeed Nelson Mandela. But then he was assassinated, just before Easter, leading up to our first democratic elections. I was at the cathedral in Cape Town when I heard. I was stunned, as were most South Africans. I got back home to Bishop's Court. Leah said to me that there have been many calls about Chris Haney. I broke down, and Leah held me like I was a baby. I think it helped because later on, I had to go and preach at his funeral. And we had a huge crowd of people who were very, very angry. I knew how they felt because I had been through the same sort of thing. And I could appeal to them, not from a superior position, but from a position of one who was with them and who had felt the same anguish and pain. It is also good to recognize, speaking from our struggle against apartheid, how incredibly noble people are. You know, human beings are basically good. You know, that's where we have to start. That everything else is an aberration. Anything that swerves away from that is the exception. Even when now and again they can be very frustrating, people are remarkably, remarkably, remarkably good. Incredible. In the generosity. And we had the opportunity of seeing this, especially during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. It was amazing to listen to people who had suffered, not only black people, you know, white people too, not only South Africans, but Americans. There was a family whose daughter had been killed, brutally killed, who came and said they supported the granting of amnesty to those who had killed their daughter so gruesomely. The parents had even opened a non-profit to help people in the township where their daughter had been murdered. And they had even employed the men who had killed their daughter, and whose amnesty they had supported. We've always got to be recognizing that, despite the aberrations, the fundamental thing about humanity, about humankind, about people, is that they are good. They were made good. And they really want to be good. Yes, there are many, many things that can depress us. But there are also very many things that are fantastic about our world. Unfortunately, the media do not report on these, because they are not seen as news.
I think you are right. When bad things happen, they become news, and it is easy to feel like our basic human nature is to kill, or to rape, or to be corrupt. Then we can feel that there is not much hope for our future. All these things happen, but they are unusual, which is why they become news. There are millions and millions of children who are loved by their parents every day. Then in school, their teachers care for them. Okay, maybe there are some bad teachers, but most of them really are kind and caring. Then, in the hospital, every day millions of people receive immense caring. But this is so common that none of it becomes news. We take it for granted. When we look at the news, we must keep this more holistic view. Yes, this or that terrible thing has happened. No doubt, there are very negative things, but at the same time, there are many more positive things happening in our world. We must have a sense of proportion and a wider perspective. Then, we will not feel despair when we see these sad things.
Neither man was asking us to look at the world through rose-colored glasses, or to not see the world with anything but a searingly honest view. The Archbishop even discouraged people from being optimistic. You've spoken, Archbishop, very powerfully about how hope is not the same as optimism. Could you tell us a little bit about the distinction you make?
Hope is quite different from optimism, which is more superficial and liable to become pessimism when the circumstances change. Hope is something much deeper. I mentioned earlier about Chris Hani, whose assassination occurred at a very critical point in the negotiations for a new democratic South Africa. We were on the edge of a precipice. It was so serious that the then president, the white president of South Africa, F.W. de Klerk, asked Nelson Mandela to address the nation. That incident could have caused the collapse of the negotiations, but it didn't, in fact. We were fortunate that we had someone like Nelson Mandela. Now, if you had been an optimist, you would have said, well, the assassination of Chris Hani is really the end of